Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and all major podcast providers. So if you can't catch the show live, you can download it or simply use our free podcast player, which is available on our website at www.theorganicview.com. If you'd like to connect with us, please post a question on our wall on Facebook or send me a tweet at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@theorganicview.com. Today's show is sponsored by Austria's Finest Naturally Authentic Pumpkin Seeds and Pumpkin Seed Oil from the Steiermark, available at organicuniverse.com. Listeners of The Organic View can receive $1 off their purchase by using the coupon code ORGVIEW. That's ORGVIEW. Also, don't forget to check out our contest section on our website to submit your information for our free monthly giveaways. For more information, please visit our website at www.theorganicview.com/contests. Today, my guest is Eric Mader, and we're going to be talking about a book called Attracting Native Pollinators that has been put out by the Xerxes Society. And let me tell you, if you are an avid gardener or if you just like having a beautiful landscape, this is one show that you definitely want to tune into, because butterflies and also some of the not-so-popular pollinators are really so important to our ecosystem. But in regards to butterflies, it's amazing how many people can't understand why they're not attracting butterflies into their gardens. It's amazing that when you do see them and you take a look at your soil, you see that, you know, you have a very healthy environment. When you see the butterflies, that is definitely a sign that your garden is healthy and fertile. But in order to attract these beautiful pollinators, there are several things that you need to know. And also, there are other pollinators that are very important that actually are essential for the livelihoods of other beings that are out there. And there's just so many different things that we have to talk about. But let me tell you, if you are an avid gardener and you really enjoy and appreciate good, solid information, the book Attracting Native Pollinators, Protecting North America's Bees and Butterflies, this is definitely one for your collection. The pictures are just beautiful, and the information is just fantastic. So I would like to welcome to the show Mr. Eric Mader. Good afternoon, Eric, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, June. It's really good to be here.
Great to have you here, and also to talk about one of my favorite subjects, which is pollinators. For those of you that really love horticulture, this is the man. He has just so many wonderful things to say about how you can help improve the health of your soil, but also to help attract and provide food for our pollinators. So, Eric, can you tell our audience about yourself and also how you became involved with the Xerxes Society?
Sure. Wow. You know, in order to answer that question, I guess I would have to sort of harken back to my childhood days in Minnesota and North Dakota, out chasing insects, chasing down butterflies and bees, and just being one of those kids that spent a lot of time outside in nature, exploring the prairies and the forests around where I lived. Interestingly, I spent most of my childhood within either a mile of the Missouri River in North Dakota or a mile within the Mississippi River in Minnesota. And so I always had that sort of natural environment around me. And as a teenager, I think I, you know, like a lot of teenagers do, I sort of got sidetracked with other interests and didn't spend as much time outside. I actually ended up going to college in Japan in my 20s.
Wow.
And lived on a rice farm in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of rural Hiroshima Prefecture. And after, you know, being a teenager with sort of typically teenage interests, I was sort of astounded to find myself back in a rural environment and an environment where I would see rice growing and see changes in the color of the rice fields every single day and see birds and insects and fish spawning in those rice paddies. And it really resonated with me. I ended up moving back to the States and working in software for a while, working in a few other things, and one day just woke up and realized, wow, you know, I kind of hate the software and technology world, and I really miss living in sort of a rural context. I went back to grad school, got my graduate work under my belt in horticulture at the University of Minnesota, ended up working as a crop consultant after that, a crop consultant actually for the native seed industry for producers of native prairie grasses and native prairie wildflowers, and worked with some of the largest native seed producers in the United States, having these amazing experiences looking at 100 acres of purple prairie clover or narrow-leafed pale purple coneflower, just some really amazing time spent out managing those crops for seed production. And really spending a lot of time also looking at bees and butterflies and the pollinators of those crops. I worked with some apple producers and some other ag industries that were really dependent on bee pollination. Became a beekeeper myself and rented bees for contract pollination. And that sort of brought me full circle. It brought me into contact with this really great organization here in Portland, based in Portland, Oregon. We now have offices nationwide, the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation.
Wow, what a fantastic background. I mean, you know, it's interesting when you take a look at someone's background and you see that they began somehow connected to nature, and then they go away from it, usually to the technology world, and then they go right back. And
yeah.
It's no surprise, but what a great story. Now, Eric, when you were asked to contribute to this book, I'm just curious, how long did it take to put this together?
Well, I guess there are sort of two answers to that question. The more glib of the two answers is that it took about 6 months from concept to printing. But I think really the more thoughtful answer is that it took about 40 years to develop this book. The Xerces Society has been around since 1971, and this book really tries to capture the organizational wisdom here at Xerces, the expertise of people who have been working on bee and butterfly conservation for decades, and the sort of guidelines and reports and research articles that have been developed here over the years all really informed the development of this book. So although, you know, apparently I'm credited as being the lead author on this book, I really have to give credit to all of the people who've started this organization and made those contributions over the years, as well as the other scientists out there who have been working on pollinators and pollinator conservation for many, many, many decades, long before pollinator conservation made any headlines at all.
Thank you. Now, in regards to pollinators, can you please talk about some of our most common pollinators here in North America? And can you explain some of the basic differences that for people that really don't have a clue as to what the difference between a bee and a butterfly is, so that they can better identify them?
Yeah. And it's actually interesting. So when we talk about pollinators, we're talking about a huge range of diverse animals worldwide. First, to give you some background context, about 85% of all plant species on Earth require some form of animal-mediated pollination, meaning that they require some animal to move pollen, which are the male gametes, the male reproductive parts of the flower, to the female reproductive parts of the flower to fertilize the ovaries and produce seed and the fruit that sometimes surrounds that seed. The animal pollinators that contribute to this service include everything from fairly obscure animals like lemurs in Madagascar, or opossums in Australia, to here in North America, a few vertebrate pollinators like bats or hummingbirds. But more commonly, the majority of all pollinators on Earth, and this is also true here in North America specifically, are invertebrate animals, especially our insects. So among our insects, some beetles are important pollinators, some moths, some butterflies. All of these different insect groups, flies, can be important pollinators, but of them, bees specifically are probably what we would consider to be the apex group of pollinators. And there are about 4,000 species of bees in North America. We typically think of the introduced European honeybee when we think of bees, but there are, in fact, this huge range of other native wild bees, bees that were here long before European Americans arrived on the continent. So people often ask why specifically bees are the apex group of pollinators and why they are considered to be the most important. And a very simplistic explanation for this is that bees are the only group of animals that actively collect and transport pollen. So they're collecting pollen from flowers as a larval food source. They bring that pollen, which is very rich in protein, they bring that back to their nest and they feed that to their offspring. If you contrast this with, say, butterflies, which are a whole different order of insects, butterflies aren't collecting pollen. They're at flowers and they're drinking nectar and they're using the carbohydrates in that nectar simply to fuel their own flight. In the process, they may be getting a little bit of pollen dusted on them and moving some of that pollen between flowers, but they're not making a point of shaking the pollen loose from those flowers and carrying large quantities of it between flowers and eventually back to their nest. And it's really the same with wasps. So people often ask, and this is a fair question, you know, what's the difference between a bee and a wasp? And a simplistic way to think about that contrast is that wasps are only collecting flower nectar as well. They're collecting flower nectar for their own energy source. For their larval food source, what they're feeding to their offspring, they're usually feeding meat to their offspring, typically in the form of other insects. And wasps, you know, they do a little bit of pollination in the process. Wasps, unfortunately, get kind of a bad rap because we think of the few non-native aggressive wasps like German yellow jackets, but many of those wasps, the insects that they are collecting are pest insects in the garden. So they're providing this pest control service for us that a lot of people don't recognize.
That's a really interesting point. And, you know, I really appreciate the fact that you said that because I'll admit, I always viewed the wasps as you know, something to be concerned about in the yard. I do have one wasp's nest on my property that I haven't touched only because they don't bother me, I don't bother them, but I never saw them as being beneficial in that regard. So, you know, that's a really, really great point. Now, if people do have wasp's nests, what do you recommend if you know, how they can better make that decision. Should I just leave this alone, or should I see if I can have it removed and, you know, relocated elsewhere?
Yeah, you know, the wasp nests that tend to be most concerning to us are those of the social wasps, things like the paper wasps and the yellow jackets. And several of those are actually non-native, and their pest control value might be something to take into consideration. But with those non-native wasps, those non-native social wasps, there's the potential that they are preying on not just pests, but in some cases our native beneficial insects, including the caterpillars of some of our native butterflies. So if you do find yourself in a position where you've got, you know, a paper wasp nest in your yard somewhere, and it's maybe sort of a threat to a regular walking path or a garden area that you spend a lot of time in, I wouldn't feel too bad about taking that nest down. You know, you going out in the middle of the night and when the wasp can't actively see you and just knocking it out of the tree if it was that much of a safety concern. But I think, June, that your approach is probably sort of the model approach. If you can leave them alone, they will generally leave you alone as well.
Yeah, my nest has been there for, I think, 5 or 6 years, and it's actually not, it's right near a path that goes to the side of my house, and I have a small flower bed that I maintain, but, you know, they don't seem to get in my way, and I obviously haven't gotten in their way. They haven't
yeah.
seen me. But it's just interesting to have the different perspective that they're beneficial because they actually are like a natural form of pesticide control, or pest control, should I say. And
yeah.
I thought that that's really, you know, very unique. And, you know, it's just an interesting way of looking at things. And so I thank you for saying that. Now, having said that, a question that I personally have is in regards to carpenter bees. And I bring this up because many people have written in and asked me about it, and I don't have any particular solutions. I just kind of feel that, well, if they're not bothering you, just leave them be. And I've had all sorts of comments from, oh, you know, you take a tennis racket and you whack them and you do all sorts of things, which I think is just horrific. What do you, can you tell our audience about the purpose of carpenter bees, and, you know, at what point do you make the decision that you need to call either a local beekeeper or someone that can relocate that nest?
Yeah, this question does come up with some frequency, especially, I should note, in the eastern United States, where one species of carpenter bee, the common eastern carpenter bee, Xylocopa virginica, is particularly common. Carpenter bees are first and foremost attracted to bare wood. And so the simplest sort of deterrent that I can recommend for folks is to paint bare wood surfaces where you can do it. Sometimes I realize that, you know, if you've got a few carpenter bees that are readily established in a particular spot, simply going and applying a coat of paint isn't always going to dissuade them from returning. They've sort of oriented themselves to that particular nest site, and they're likely to go back to it. But if you can keep bare wood surfaces painted or treated in some way, it will deter carpenter bees from nesting in those spots. Now, they do come out of those nests from time to time, and they'll appear oftentimes to chase you around or to circle you when you're walking within the vicinity of their nest.
They're almost like little bullies.
Yeah. A lot of that behavior is, I think, primarily due to territorial male carpenter bees that are just wanting to keep you away from their prospective mates and their prospective mates' nesting sites. Male bees in general, actually male bees, without exception, cannot sting. So although they may have a lot of bluster and they may be circling your head and buzzing ferociously, there's really nothing they can do to you. People are sometimes worried about the structural damage caused by carpenter bees. They will excavate tunnels that are about the depth and diameter of a pencil. Now, if you have huge numbers of carpenter bees, that structural damage could add up over time. But it's very, very uncommon to see carpenter bees nesting in big aggregations where they're likely to cause that much structural damage. So the damage they do cause to things like decks or railings is somewhat akin to that of that damage caused by, say, a large nail hole in those structures. They're not in their tunneling much beyond a few inches in depth. They're not making large maze-like caverns like carpenter bees or carpenter ants or termites will. Mm. So the amount of structural loss to any sort of building is really, really minimal. And they're fascinating insects. I think they're a nice insect to encounter sometimes as a teaching moment to the general public, giving them a sense that not all bees live in hives and not all bees have the same sort of social structure as honeybees do, and carpenter bees are sort of a nice example of that. If you can paint surfaces, if you can tolerate a few carpenter bees here and there, I think that's probably the best that any of us could do in terms of tolerating them. I do know of at least one person who I've had some contact with via email over the past few years has very dedicatedly cut wood blocks out of his deck over the years that carpenter bees have nested in, and just replaced that part of the deck and then kept these carpenter bee nests off in his garden and has created these little sort of carpenter bee condos out in the garden using wood blocks. Yeah.
As far as the environment, what function do they perform?
So carpenter bees are generalist pollinators, similar to bumblebees or honeybees, meaning that they visit many different types of flowers. They tend to be really great sort of all-purpose summer vegetable garden pollinators. They're out there. You'll see them in the squash sometimes. They'll be in the spring. They may be visiting apple blossoms if you have apple trees in your yard. They do sometimes get a reputation for robbing nectar from flowers without accessing the reproductive structures, the anthers of the flower that contain pollen. And there's some truth to them doing that with small flowers, things like blueberries. But for the most part, you know, they're contributing to the pollination of the foods that we eat as much as many other bees are.
Thank you. Now, speaking of food, how can we create a foraging habitat for our pollinators?
Great question. So there are sort of, if we actually broaden this question out and think about pollinator conservation in general, there are sort of three pillars to doing pollinator conservation that anybody can implement, whether you have a inner city apartment with a balcony garden or whether you are a farmer with hundreds of acres of crops that need pollinating. You can, regardless of who you are, you can implement these three practices for pollinator conservation. The first of those is to minimize or eliminate pesticide use to the greatest degree possible. And there are, for many, many different types of human food crops or ornamental plants, there are sound, very sound, scientifically demonstrated alternatives to pesticides. And a lot of those are featured in the Attracting Native Pollinators book. The second thing that you can do is to provide a succession of blooming plants throughout the growing season. Primarily native blooming plants, native wildflowers. And what I mean by a succession is having wildflowers that bloom in the spring, wildflowers that bloom in the summer, and wildflowers that bloom in the fall. A lot of our bees and butterflies and other pollinating animals need food to sustain them throughout the growing season. So providing things that are in bloom in each season will ensure that you have healthy populations of pollinators. And then the third thing, the final thing that you can do is to conserve, protect, or enhance overwintering and egg-laying sites for these animals. This is not necessarily beekeeping where you would go out and create a hive for native bees like you would for honeybees, but you can provide things like brush piles. You can practice what we at the Xerces Society call benign neglect of your landscape, where you leave areas of the garden that are not mowed, that are maybe a little bit unkempt, where you have a couple of stumps or some large rocks, all of those sorts of little crevices that are created by that structure in the landscape, that sort of messy structure, those are potential nest sites and egg-laying sites for all of these animals. If you can provide for those three things, you are doing pollinator conservation.
I will have to mention that the next time somebody makes a comment that I haven't mowed the lawn, recently. But thank you for your support. That's something that I learned also volunteering at my county's butterfly garden. It's just amazing what we tend to think of as unkempt and messy and sloppy is not necessarily a bad thing as far as the environment is concerned. And if you look at the homes where the lawns are pristine, where there's not one dandelion, and I remember giving a lecture on dandelions in which I had a picture of a man who was on his hands and knees with a magnifying glass looking at, a young dandelion that had begun to grow on his lawn. And it's just amazing what people do because they think that they're doing the right thing. They're being good neighbors. They're keeping their lawns as green as possible, but they're not thinking about, okay, well, what is dependent upon the things that you're growing on your land? And if everybody's dumping all sorts of chemicals to keep their lawn free from different, what they call weeds, that basically contributes to the problem. It's interesting. I don't do anything to get rid of my dandelions, and I happen to like dandelions. I eat them, and I think I do my part by allowing them to grow as soon as they pop up in the spring until they die off in the winter. But it's just amazing that is it not a great plant for our pollinators?
It generally is, and I'll speak specifically here to dandelions here for a moment, but then I have sort of a larger thought on this issue of yard maintenance in general. But dandelions are a very good pollinator plant for a lot of generalist flies and bees. You'll sometimes even see butterflies nectaring on it as well. It does have barely accessible nectar in the flowers. It does have a lot of pollen, and like most insect-pollinated plants, that pollen is actually sticky, so it's not wind-borne. It doesn't contribute to allergies like wind-pollinated plants such as grasses and conifers do. The protein content of dandelions is fairly good, but it is missing a few amino acids that some bees need as sort of a full protein source. But that's not a huge issue because bees are generally collecting different pollen sources anyway and mixing them together, much like humans are mixing different food sources together to create a complete and nutritious diet. But I think the larger point that's worth mentioning is that, you know, this way in which we've sanitized nature, I think that we are learning, perhaps the hard way, that this, and you said it better than I can, this sort of idea of being a good neighbor by having these really manicured environments, I think we're learning the hard way that this mythology is not just detrimental to our environment, but I think it's detrimental to our social networks as well. And I'll give you the example of my own yard here in Portland, Oregon. And I live actually in a, I guess a polite word for it would be a very working class neighborhood in inner city Portland, where people, you know, keep pit bulls behind chain link fences and don't have a lot of direct contact with their neighbors, even their next door neighbors. And when I moved into this neighborhood, the house that I bought had the traditional turf grass yard, and I knew none of my neighbors. One of the first things I did with that house was to kill all of the turf grass and turn the entire front yard into a wildflower meadow.
Oh, wow.
And in the process of doing that, I have met every single person on my block. I've met people up and down the street. I have people who take walks in the evening specifically to come over and look at my yard and look at the bees and butterflies and hummingbirds in it. And without bringing some of that nature, some of that natural world back into this neighborhood, I never would have made those human connections.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, I remember years ago, I had some friends that would frequently fly to the States from Europe, and they would make a beeline to my home and bring their own wine, bring some cheese, and hang out in my garden. And, you know, they didn't really want to see me. They just wanted the peacefulness and the serenity of my garden. And I always thought that that was quite amusing. But, you know, when you see something that's beautiful, when you see the tranquility and the peacefulness that it brings, who wouldn't want to be a part of it?
Yeah, I think that's totally right. If you can create a beautiful landscape, people, even people who don't own that landscape, feel a sense of investment in it and are willing to protect it and take it seriously.
Now, Eric, since you created that environment in front of your home, how many houses have followed, or how many people have followed your lead and have incorporated that type of landscape into their own home environment?
More than a few, actually. I guess I really hadn't thought about that until you asked me, but definitely more than a few. I've had neighbors come over and actually ask for seed from some of those flowers, because that's one of the things I do is I go out and deadhead the flowers and collect the seed, and I've, you know, been giving the seed away to friends and families, but I've actually had neighbors come over and ask for particular flowers because they want to put that in their yard or in their garden. And I've just noticed within the past couple of weeks, I've got another house one block over that tore the grass out of their parking strip and have seeded all of that in wildflowers now.
It's amazing when you look at something and it's different, but it starts getting that whole process going where you're thinking to yourself, hey, you know, this guy did something pretty smart here, and maybe if he did it and it looks that good, I could do it to my land, and I bet any money it'll increase the value of my property if I do this. And that's how people think, especially in this day and age. And it's amazing how many people have now turned their front lawns into meadows and even edible gardens. And I think it's fantastic. I mean, just that whole turn, if you will, from going to this mentality where the lawn has to be this pristinely kept piece of land to something that provides not just a function for us as human beings for food, but for food for the pollinators and other beings that are dependent upon the food that's available in the environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully there'll be more of that trend in the years to come.
I think so. I mean, I'm starting to see it quite a bit, especially working with the public, and just when you talk to people that are looking to improve their home environment, or if they just want to improve the environment in general. I mean, most people would rather have the type of environment that you described, where you have these beautiful flowers and it's peaceful, it's beautiful to look at, it's just very calming, than just a patch of lawn where, no, it's kind of boring.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Maybe it's just that I'm biased. I'm not a big lawn person. I just I look at the lawn like it's just another job where I will gladly spend hours just working away in different garden beds where I'm growing specific plants that I know are beneficial to the pollinators. And speaking of which, do you have any suggestions that people that are located specifically in the United States, I mean, all over the world, you can check with your local university to find out what a good starting place would be. But if you're located in the United States, do you have any particular plants that you would recommend?
It really comes down to the part of the country that you live in. The book Attracting Native Pollinators does have a plant appendix, a fairly robust appendix of pollen and nectar plants, as well as some regional sample plant lists. But to give you a sense of what some of those species might be in places like California or the West Coast, you might be looking at species like California poppy or any of the native lupins. We have some really beautiful native lupins on the West Coast. We've got the lacy phacelia here on the West Coast as well, which is a total bee magnet. If you move farther to the east, sort of in the Rocky Mountains or the Great Plains, there are the native goldenrods and asters. There are native sunflowers. There are these really fascinating group of plants in sort of the central U.S. called the silphiums that include things like cup plant and compass plant, these huge sunflower-like plants that get in some cases 10 feet tall and have tap roots that extend down another 10 feet into the ground. Farther east still, like in the Appalachians, in the Mid-Atlantic, and in New England, we have our beautiful milkweeds, our Joe Pye weeds. There's also the eastern wild perennial lupin in the northeast. There is wild mountain mint, purple coneflower. All of these are native plants to their respective range. These native plants, unlike a lot of the horticultural varieties, don't have improved flowers, and they still have the pollen and nectar freely accessible to the bees and butterflies that might visit them. So that's sort of a brief list. I'll tell you, if I had to focus on a couple of plants, specifically a couple of big groups of plants that get sort of a bad reputation but are really important to a lot of different animals, there are two groups of plants, two great groups of pollinator plants that probably deserve special recognition regardless of where you are in the United States. And the first of those are the milkweeds, the genus Asclepias. Milkweeds have been unfortunately plagued by having the word weed in their name, and they've been considered sort of an agricultural weed in especially the corn and soybean growing regions. But we have an amazing diversity of milkweeds across the United States, the majority of which, the vast majority of which, are not found in agricultural settings at all. And as I'm sure you know, Junlin, milkweeds are the absolute required larval host plant for monarch butterfly caterpillars. We have had, in the past 15 years, we've had enormous declines in monarch butterfly populations. Mm. There are two different groups of monarchs in the United States. They're the same species, but we have an eastern population that overwinters in Mexico, and we have a western population west of the Rocky Mountains that overwinters on the California coast. These butterflies, if you're looking at the eastern population, there's a new research paper out that has demonstrated a decline of about 81% in our monarch butterfly numbers over the past 15 years or so.
Wow, that's
if you look at, if you look at our western monarch population, we've seen almost a 90% decline in those monarch butterfly numbers in the past 15 years. There are real threats to the overwintering sites of these animals. On the California coast, we have the loss of habitat, the loss of these trees that they overwinter in. And then in Mexico, illegal logging and deforestation and some of the general lawlessness has resulted in the loss of overwintering sites. We can't really do much about that. There are maybe some larger policy issues that can get at providing more protection for those, especially those Mexican overwintering sites, but those are above my pay grade. The one thing that we can do, that we can easily do, is we can incorporate milkweeds into our pollinator gardens, into our backyard native plant gardens. We can incorporate them back into natural areas. We can revegetate roadsides with these really magnificent native plants that don't only support monarch butterflies, but they also support huge numbers of native bees, of managed honeybees, of hummingbirds, of other butterflies who are drinking the nectar from these flowers. Milkweeds are nectar factories. They produce huge amounts of nectar.
Well, the flowers are absolutely beautiful.
They are tremendously beautiful. And if you have an opportunity to see any of our native eastern milkweeds, like the butterfly milkweed or the swamp red milkweed, you're looking at some of the most beautiful plants that you will find in their environment. If you have a chance to even see some of the more uncommon desert milkweeds of the desert southwest, they are beautiful on an order of several magnitude greater than even our Midwest or our Northeast milkweeds. They have really astounding forms and flowers and shapes to them. Anything we can do to bring back milkweeds will help bring back monarch butterflies. The other group of plants that have gotten a bad rap, and they also occur nationwide, are our native thistles. So we have a number of native thistles in this country that unfortunately have been lumped together with these invasive non-native thistles like bull thistle or Canada thistle, which truly are weeds, which truly are invasive plants and do take over landscapes. But unfortunately, we have not been good at discerning our true native thistles with these non-native ones. And in fact, our native thistles, in many cases, are disappearing at a really alarming rate. These native thistles are host plants for a lot of uncommon moths and butterflies. Many, many moths and butterflies and hummingbirds and bees collect nectar from thistle flowers. Many different songbirds eat the seed of our native thistles. And if you have a chance to see some of these native thistles, the flowers, much like the milkweed flowers, they're really magnificent to see. We have actual states now that have native thistles on their endangered species list.
Oh, wow, no kidding. Huh.
Yeah, and those same states are still maintaining efforts to control invasive thistles. And many times the people out there controlling weeds don't understand the difference and can't distinguish between the two. So that's my plug for native milkweeds and native thistles, two really, really great groups of native wildflowers.
Now with thistle, I remember when I lived on my parents' farm, my father always let the thistle alone. He said, you know, the horses love that. They love to eat the thistle. And he said that they also have medicinal properties. And, he was very pro-organic back before organic was even heard of or became, should I say, trendy as it is today. But for the most part, I think for the average gardener, if people see thistle pop up, they usually pull it out just because of the fact that it is it hurts if you brush against it, but because I know that it is a beneficial flower, I tend to leave it. But I did not know that about thistle. That's really, really interesting. And in regards to the milkweed, I just want to point out that if you don't have, or if you're concerned that the milkweed is going to take over your garden, one of the things that you can do is plant it in a container. And you can just cut it back. So that's always an option. And it's interesting to see how many small gardens, community gardens and school gardens, that children have the opportunity to contribute and maintain, they are planting the milkweed. So, you know, I think that when you're out in the garden, and especially if you do have milkweed, and the flowers are blooming, it's magnificent when you see a whole bunch of monarchs that are all over the milkweed. I mean, it's just, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to see when you have those moments. And milkweeds are one of those plants that can do this, where you'll have the whole different insect community in your area represented on one single flower, where you'll have those monarchs and you'll have maybe some honeybees and some bumblebees and some small solitary sweat bees and maybe some flower flies. All of these different groups will converge on those milkweed flowers. And thistles are much like that as well. They're important for that purpose because they are truly magnets to these animals.
Thank you. And one of the other things that I wanted to point out is some of the plants that are listed in the book are actually grown for culinary purposes, such as basil, dill, cilantro, and I thought that was quite interesting when I started volunteering for our local herb garden committee, and it was just interesting to see how many plants were plants that I would grow, you know, for culinary purposes that were actually beneficial to the butterflies.
Yeah, yeah. Most of our kitchen herbs do fall into that category. And if you'll let them flower, you will see big numbers of insects on them. The same is true of a lot of your vegetable garden plants that you might not normally think of as flowering plants as well. So if you think about things like cabbage or broccoli or even carrots in your garden, if you want sort of an interesting experiment in attracting pollinators, you can always leave a couple of those plants unharvested in a corner of your garden and just let them bolt, let them go to flower. And that's a really simple way of providing some additional floral resources as well.
Do you have any recommendations for people that are out there listening today that have children that would like to, just conduct different exercises with their kids where they can observe the pollinators and perhaps take down some of the information and send that into the Xerxes Society?
Yeah, I've got a couple of different resources that I could direct folks to. The first is simply in the back of the book, in the back of the Attracting Native Pollinators book, there is a appendix with some ideas for educators and ideas for parents on small experiments or observations that you can conduct with kids outside. Also on our website at www.xerces.org, we do have a page on the website that has ideas and resources for educators. We also have a really fun set of free downloadable pocket identification guides for bumblebees in different regions of the country. We have actually a group of bumblebees across the country that are in really steep decline. We are worried that some of these native bumblebees may now actually be teetering on the brink of extinction. But these downloadable pocket identification guides that people can print out in full color and fold up and they can fit into a wallet, you can use these with kids or you can use these with community groups to go out and conduct your own monitoring for bumblebees. You can actually be out looking at bees on flowers. You can try to take, you know, everybody has access to a reasonable digital camera, it seems, these days. Most of us are out taking photos on our phone, even. And using these pocket ID guides, you can be out doing that. You can be snapping photos of these bumblebees and then sending them back to us here at the Xerces Society. And we are using that information to track occurrences of these rare bumblebees and using that information to help prioritize conservation efforts across the country. So it's this nationwide citizen science bumblebee monitoring effort that anybody can take part in.
Thank you. Now, if people want to join the Xerxes Society and become a member, do they necessarily have to live in the United States, or is it open to everyone globally?
We are an international nonprofit organization, and we do have some members overseas. The bulk of our membership is here in the U.S., but because we're a nonprofit, memberships and donations to us are tax deductible. The Xerxes Society, just to give you some background context and to give your listeners some additional context, the Xerxes Society is 40 years old this year. And while we do have this great pollinator conservation program, we have a number of other programs as well. We have an endangered species program, which directs conservation efforts towards things like freshwater mussels. Freshwater mussels are probably the single most imperiled group of animals on Earth. And we have a great program that devotes conservation research and conservation efforts to those animals. We have a aquatics invertebrate conservation program that is doing some fascinating work right now with migratory dragonflies, dragonflies that actually migrate between Canada and the United States and Mexico, sometimes following the same migration routes as raptors do. And the support that we get from members actually helps all of these different programs within the Xerces Society. So the Xerces Society has historically been this sort of pollinator and butterfly organization, but we really focus on invertebrate animals everywhere that we have the capacity to do so. And I should mention, the question hasn't come up yet, but it always inevitably does. The Xerces Society name comes from the now extinct Xerces blue butterfly, the first butterfly to go extinct in North America as a result of human land development.
Yeah, it's amazing that when we suffer such a loss, by remembering through such an amazing organization such as the Xerces Society, we can think about what we've done in the past in order to prevent it from happening again in the future. So thank you for bringing that up. And, you know, folks, once again, please visit www.xerces.org. And let me tell you, there is so much information on here, as well as a list of all of the different publications. And there is... there's something here for everyone, not to mention, especially if you have children or if you're an educator or if you just want to share the information with your with the community garden club that you belong to or just with friends that happen to share the same passion with gardening that you do. I mean, just the information here is just fantastic. And Eric, can you talk about some of the programs that you have? Because, I mean, they're just amazing.
Yeah, we have a number of different events that are going on nationwide at any given time. If folks go to our website and look under the Support Us tab, there's a calendar of different events. Our largest and perhaps most comprehensive event related to pollinator conservation is our Pollinator Conservation Short Course, which is a full-day workshop that takes participants through the sort of simple fundamentals of what pollinators are, what is a bee, how is a bee different from a wasp, what are the life history and ecology needs of these animals, to more in-depth topics like habitat restoration for pollinators, bee-friendly farming and gardening practices for pollinators, and linking people into additional resources for pollinators, where we will walk people through the process of signing up for different USDA cost share grants for doing pollinator conservation on your land. And we do have some hands-on activities that are usually part of those short courses as well, where we're actually looking at examples of pollinators and practicing bee identification skills or going out in the field and conducting habitat assessment exercises where we'll look at a flock or a landscape and try to identify what are the important parts of that landscape for pollinators and focus on protecting those.
Eric, thank you so much. It has been wonderful having you on the show today and also just being able to talk about your wonderful book, Attracting Native Pollinators, Protecting North America's Bees and Butterflies. This is just such a beautifully written book. The photographs are magnificent. So are the guides that you have. And, you know, thank you for taking the time to put all the energy and effort that you did into this book and making it available to people so that people can take better care of the environment and also create a better habitat for our very precious pollinators.
Thank you so much, June.
Everyone, we are out of time. But thank you so much for tuning in. And if you've missed the show, you can always subscribe to The Organic View on iTunes or visit our podcast archives at www.theorganicview.com. Have a great day, everyone.